Hello and welcome. My name is Alejandro Torres Orjuela. I'm a PhD student at the Peking University, and today I'm talking about the phase shift of gravitational waves induced by aberration. This is a paper I published a couple of months ago together with my two supervisors, Professor Chen Qian, who works here at the Peking University, and Pau Amaro Seoane, who works at the ICE in Barcelona. The content of my presentation is as follows. First, I will talk about moving sources because the aberrational phase shift is related to moving sources, and I will explain why we think that the moving sources themselves are interesting and which kind of moving sources we think are the most interesting ones. In the second part of my presentation, I will talk about the templates used for gravitational wave detection and how these are related to the motion of the source, basically, which formalisms exist for the production of templates, and if they can include motion or not. In the third part of my presentation, I will talk about accelerated motion and the phase. This means how an accelerated motion can affect the phase of a gravitational wave, where the two components affecting it are basically the Doppler shift, which is probably well known to the most of you, and the aberrational phase shift, which is the new thing I want to introduce. Then in the final part of my presentation, I will talk about the detection of aberrational phase shift, like how strong is the phase shift itself due to the aberration, and how easy is this going to detect in real experiments. Let's start with the moving sources. I will start with a quotation from Isaac Newton's Mathematical Foundations of Natural Philosophy from 1846, where he says, "Nor are those bodies always truly at rest, which commonly are taken to be so." Okay, it's fair enough to assume that Isaac Newton was not thinking about gravitational wave sources when he wrote this sentence, but he was talking about moving bodies in general. Especially in astrophysics, we tend to assume that sources are at rest. The reasons are they're usually very far away, so we don't really see any motion of them in the sky. And also, usually it makes things easier to just assume, okay, the source is at rest. But strictly speaking, this is in general not true. And this is something which sometimes can be very important. So, why do we think our gravitational, the motion of gravitational wave sources could be important for the sources themselves? This is because, let me show you this plot here. In this plot from a work from my professor Chen Qian, he plotted the chirp mass of the 10 detections that have been detected up to now over the distance to the sources. And there you can see there are basically like two kinds of groups, the red and the blue dots. The blue dots are sources which are very light or relatively light with masses of around less than 10 solar masses in the chirp mass, and that are also quite close. To have light sources close to us is not very surprising because usually light sources are not very strong. Sources where the black holes are light are not very strong. So, of course, we cannot see them very far away. Therefore, also that we see more or heavier sources more far away at the first point doesn't appear very special. But what is maybe special is that the heavier the sources, the more far away they tend to be. Or this is an impression you can somehow get from this plot. And the question is, okay, why are heavy sources always far away or almost always far away? This is does need don't need to be. Of course, we can see them better if they are heavier, more far away, but they don't need to be. And in special, you see like kind of a gap here between the light close sources and the heavy far away sources. The point is, or maybe the point is, that when a source is moving, also when the source is close to a gravitational potential or the other things, it can be redshifted. But let's here pay attention in particular to the motion. And when it is redshifted due to the motion, this means that the mass, as well as the distance that you see as an observer, is the original mass and the original distance times 1 plus the velocity to lowest order. Therefore, a moving source could appear to be more massive and more far away. And that's what we think is that these plots somehow suggest that this is true for gravitational wave sources, or at least for some of them, it is true. Of course, tensor sources are not the best thing to make statistics. We will have to see if in the future this gap here is filled with other detections, but maybe not. Then this is, of course, a very strong hint. And even if it is partially filled, the idea still remains that it could be true that moving, that some sources are moving with high velocities or relatively high velocities, and therefore they appear redshifted. This is an important fact to know because, of course, the mass of the black holes is important information, if not the most important information on black holes, and also their distribution, their distance is very important for us. So we think this is a very important point to resolve. But why do we think they are moving? Of course, the plot gives some hints, but which kind of motions we think there exist? And the first point is that gravitational wave sources are not completely isolated. As I said, we tend to think that things are isolated because it makes easy. Simulations usually start from the point of thinking of the gravitational wave sources being isolated, but this is not really true. They are most likely in some host galaxy, and the host galaxy itself will be moving, the so-called peculiar motion, because usually galaxies are self-organized in clusters and all the galaxies are falling towards the center of this cluster, which causes you a peculiar velocity. But also maybe more important, because they are in a galaxy or they are in a cluster, they will be interacting with another body or with the whole galaxy itself, and will be orbiting a central potential, the center of the galaxy. A supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy could be another possibility, or just a third body which is bound to the binary, which is emitting the gravitational wave. So that gravitational wave sources are not isolated will almost always cause them to be moving, or strictly speaking, they are will always be moving due to the fact that they are in some systems. Then there is also another point, namely that gravitational waves itself carry momentum. So when a gravitational wave source is emitting the waves, it is causing, it is emitting at the same time some momentum. And it has been seen in simulations that when that this momentum emitted can be strong enough to cause a so-called recoil or kick of the source. One important thing is that this velocity is time dependent, both the recoil velocity and also the orbital motion. So sources are most likely to be in some systems which will cause them to move. And even if they will be not in such system, they will start to moving by themselves. So we think motion is something very important. Let's discuss the two kinds of motions we think are the most interesting one or most important. The first one are the kick sources I just mentioned. A kick works basically as follows. At the beginning, the gravitational wave source is emitting weak waves, so nothing happens or not much happens. But the closer it gets to the merger, the stronger the gravitational wave emission starts to be. And the source starts to wiggling a bit around until very close to the merger, where it usually makes like here a kind of loop. And at the end, it gets a strong kick in one particular direction and it goes away in a linear motion. However, it builds up, and this building up is of course an accelerated, therefore, as I mentioned, time-dependent velocity. Some information about this recoil velocity. First, it appears only if the binary black hole is asymmetric. But what means asymmetric? This means that two black holes don't have perfectly equal masses, or they don't have perfectly aligned spins. So the most of the sources, or the most realistic sources, are probably not going to be perfectly symmetric. So at the end, almost all sources will suffer a kick. How strong, of course, then depends on the properties of the source and how asymmetric they are. One important thing about these velocities is that they can go from several hundred up to several thousand kilometers per second. So the velocities that can be reached due to these kicks are extremely high, or can be extremely high. And these velocities are independent of the mass of the system. This is because the gravitational wave emission itself is proportional to the mass of the system. So the momentum emitted is proportional to the mass of the system, the acceleration is proportional to the mass of the system, and therefore the final velocity is independent mass of the system. Therefore, these kicks are suffered by stellar mass black holes, as well as by, for example, supermassive black holes. And these velocities can exceed even the escape velocities of the most massive galaxies. Therefore, imagine you have a galaxy merger, both galaxies have a supermassive black hole in the center of them, but then when they merge, because they most likely are not going to be perfectly symmetric, probably one galaxy is bigger and has a slightly bigger black hole, they're going to suffer a kick, and this kick could be strong enough to kick the new form supermassive black hole out of the new form galaxy. This would have a major impact in the evolution of the galaxy, and also in our idea of how supermassive black holes evolved. This could have a great impact. Therefore, these kicks are very interesting because they are most likely to happen for all of them, for all black holes. They are going to be quite strong, and they can have an impact even if you are not interested in gravitational waves themselves, but for the evolution of galaxies, for the evolution of supermassive black holes and these kind of things. The second kind of source we think are very interesting is something we call triples, where we are not as strict with the term triples as maybe other people. By triples, we basically mean just a binary of similar mass black holes, most likely stellar mass black holes, emitting gravitational waves, which are orbiting a third body or a third potential. This can be the center of the cluster or the center of the galaxy, or even really a third body. Then this is what people usually call the triple, but for us, it's not as important what the third body really is. Here, the velocities can also go from hundreds to thousand kilometers per second, depending on what the third bodies are circling, but they can even go to much higher velocities in very extreme cases. For example, for a supermassive black hole in the center, the velocities can reach easy relativistic velocities. This is interesting because, of course, this is a motion which is very likely to appear for almost all sources. As I explained, binary blacks are most probably formed in systems, especially in dense systems. So you will have a deep potential, and there will be always a kind of orbital motion, or very likely there will be a kind of orbital motion. But especially the special case of a supermassive black hole being orbit, we think is very interesting. One point is, of course, because of the high velocity that they can reach, that means the effect of the velocity is going to be very strong, and it will be more important to consider it. But also because in that case, you would have a very special kind of source. Strictly speaking, two sources, but for us it will appear like almost one source, namely the binary black hole emitting gravitational wave at high frequency, for example LIGO frequency in the kilohertz band, and this binary which form like a compact body orbiting the supermassive black hole, which are something you call EMRIs, or because here is a binary usually called a BEMRI for binary EMRI. And this BEMRI is emitting gravitational waves in low frequency, like in millihertz band. If you are lucky, that means in the LISA band. And then you would have almost one source, like for you to appear like being one source, which is emitting gravitational waves in two completely different windows, in the high frequency window and in the low frequency window, which will allow you to make extraordinary tests of general relativity, which you cannot perform with any other source, because it's not very likely that you will have another kind of source emitting gravitational waves at two frequencies with 10 to the 6th difference in their order. Okay, after introducing the sources, Let's go to the templates and the motion. What are templates? I'm not sure if all of you know what gravitational wave templates are and how they are used, so I will give a short introduction. The point is, when you have a gravitational wave detection, like the one here, plotted here, which is the first detection made by LIGO back in 2015, then what you have, your detection is a lot of noise, all the time some low noise, and then you get a gravitational wave or something which looks like a gravitational wave, which is a stronger wiggling of your detectors or a stronger reaction of your detectors to something. If you have this strong detection or this strong reaction at two different places, like here in Hanford and Livingston, then you can think, okay, most likely this is going to be really a gravitational wave and not another thing like a car passing by or something like that. But still, the only thing that you have here is more or less this reaction, and you need like some extra information to extract your gravitational wave from there. And what a very common way to do is using the so-called match filtering, which is you take a theoretical template and you compare your gravitational wave detection, or what you think is to gravitational wave detection, to your theoretical templates. Then if your detection is similar enough to your template, you can claim, okay, I have a detection of gravitational waves. Moreover, this is not only important for claiming that you have a detection itself, but also for the interpretation. Because here, okay, the gravitational wave source is quite strong, you have it to places, you would be probably quite sure that it's a detection. But now how do you get the information out of this ups and downs, out of this wiggling from your source? For that you need, again, a comparison. And what the people do is they take different templates and they look which template describes your detection best. And from there, because you know the properties of your system you used for to create your template, you can then get the information out of what detection you made. So templates are extremely important for the detection and interpretation of gravitational wave sources. However, as I said, templates are a theoretical production, and how you produce these templates is important to understand and important to know. Therefore, in the next this slide, I will talk about the different formalisms that exist, or the common use formalisms in LIGO for make detections of gravitational wave sources and how they're related to a motion of the center of mass of the system. Okay, let's first start with the so-called NR, or numerical relativity templates, which are also related to so-called surrogate models. But surrogate models, simply speaking, is just like extending your results from numerical relativity. So they are completely coupled to numerical relativity and just contain the same information, just extended, if you want to say it in a very simple way. So numerical relativity, what they do is they take the Einstein's equation for general relativity and they really solve them numerically step by step. They set up the system as they think how it is at the starting point and then evolve it. So this is a very powerful tool. It gives you the best results, but it's also a very expensive tool because the differential equations in general relativity are very complicated. So these have some restrictions. For example, the simulations they usually can do are quite short, just a couple of orbits before the two black holes merge. And this also puts you some restriction of the center of mass motion. For example, if you want to describe the motion of your source far before merger, it's almost impossible because you cannot perform those simulations. It's just, or you could, but it would be too expensive to do it. Moreover, even if you try to do it for close to the merger, because they are moving, you would need a bigger grid to make your simulations if you really want to put it in the simulations. which would make again everything more expensive and more difficult. So they can in principle contain the motion, but only in a restricted way. What numerical relativity simulations include are, for example, kicks. Because the kicks are a result of the merger themselves, they are always in there, and kicks can be very well described with numerical relativity simulations, or basically kicks were the first time observed in numerical relativity simulations, if you want to put it that way. Okay, let's go to the next formalism. This is the post-Newtonian formalism. This is like complementary to the numerical relativity. This is an expansion you can make, taking assuming low velocity of your system. So what about the center of most motion? Of course, the expansion themselves already tell the velocity must be quite low. This is the first restriction. But another restriction is that because of the low velocity approximation you do, this only works for the early stages of your merger. So that's why I say it's complementary. The post-Newtonian can give you some information about the inspired part, but cannot tell you much about the merger itself. Moreover, there is another point about the center of motion and post-Newtonian formalism, that not only that it is assumed to be low velocity, also the calculations of post-Newtonian, the post-Newtonian formulas are usually performed in the center of mass frame of the system. So basically the frame where you cannot describe the center of mass motion. This is done because without, like in another rest system, you have something like around 120 terms in your equations to solve. And you, when you go to the center of mass motion, you have something around 20 terms you have to take care of. So you get rid of about 100 terms. Therefore, in post-Newtonian formalism, you in principle could include the center of mass motion if it is not too high, but it's usually not done and it's a lot of work to really do it. So basically you can say no, post-Newtonian is not really well fitted to describe the center of mass motion. The two other formalisms are the so-called effective one-body formalism, where you reduce your problem effectively to one body orbiting a second one. And the phenom models, which is a phenomenological model, which again, simply speaking, you could say it's trying just to copy information you know from numerical relativity and post-Newtonian. For the phenom model, it's obvious if they are just like trying to copy, of course, with some understanding of the problem, but somehow fitting the results to post-Newtonian and numerical relativity, then phenom models are going to be restricted by everything which restricts numerical relativity and post-Newtonian, and therefore phenom models are not able to describe the center of mass motion unless you find a way to put it in there which is independent of numerical relativity and post-Newtonian. And for effective one-body, it's similar to phenom. They, in principle, produce their own results, but they need to be calibrated. And this calibration is usually done relative to numerical relativity simulations and post-Newtonian simulations. So the effective one-body is also somehow restricted through numerical relativity and post-Newtonian. And again, you could try to implement somehow the motion, but you would need a clear understanding. Therefore, in general, you can say there is no formalism which can describe a general motion. They can describe parts of the general of a motion of the center of mass, but not in general. And if you want to include it somehow, you need to understand how the motion affects your gravitational wave. So therefore, let's go to the effect of an accelerated motion on the phase. We know the phase of gravitational waves is the part which encloses the most important information. Therefore, we think if you want to describe this motion somehow, the first point to start is with the phase. Okay. Something which was previously known and has been studied by several people is the effect of the Doppler effect on the gravitational waves. Here in this plot from Gerosa, he shows basically what happens with the gravitational wave if there is a kick building up close to the merger with an exaggerated velocity so that you can see it by eye, which is pointing towards the observer. In that case, you have your original wave in black being de-shifted with time, your red line. So you, as an observer, see that your gravitational wave source lasts longer and longer the more the velocity builds up compared to your original wave. For the velocity pointing away from the observer, you have the same, but here the frequencies increase and therefore the phase is shorter than in the original case. By comparing this defacing of your moving gravitational wave source to a non-moving gravitational wave source, you can detect the velocity. This is something that Garrosa showed in his paper, where he only considered the Doppler effect. Again, only considering the Doppler effect, Inayoshi and Mayron could also show that this can be detected, the motion along the line of sight. This is also a point that will be important later, can be detected for kicks and for triples. So after we saw that this happens, or that the motion can be detected due to the Doppler shift, we were wondering, is this really the only thing that can happen? Because a gravitational wave ray is described by its wave vector, which contains the frequency, the time component, the frequency, plus three spatial components, which are not related, which are not directly affected by the Doppler effect. The Doppler effect only affects the time component. But there is another effect, the aberrational effect, which affects the spatial component. How is that? Here, this plot shows a light source, but it works the same for gravitational wave sources, emitting light in all directions equally. And here it is moving with a velocity, again, a very exaggerated value to see it well, of 0.89c. What you see is that the frequencies appear Doppler shifted, therefore the different color. When you are toward, when the velocity is pointing towards you, it appears extremely blue shifted, here lila shifted, and when you are at the opposite side, then you appear, the light appears extremely red shifted. But the aberration effect is a bending of your rays. These two dark black lines should be perpendicular, or are perpendicular in the source rest frame. But due to the motion, these rays are bended towards the direction of the velocity. This is the aberration effect. Now the question is this going somehow to affect your phase? And our answer is yes. Why? For that, let me first explain you how the phase of a gravitational wave source is in general related to the line of sight or to the particular ray we are seeing. For that, let's only consider this side. The point is that you see a maxima of your gravitational wave whenever a black hole of a binary passes by. Here we are assuming they are equal mass, to keep everything simple, by the way. In this equal mass black hole, when one of these black holes passes by, then you see a maxima. When it starts go away, your gravitational wave goes down until the other starts to get closer. And then when the second black hole passes again by this line of sight, then you see again a maxima. Therefore, a period of a gravitational wave is basically the time between one black hole and the second black hole passing through this line of sight. Now what happens if your source is moving with a time-dependent velocity? For you as an observer, which is extremely far away from the source appears to be all the time at the same place. You will not see the source moving. Therefore, in the observer's frame, the line of sight appears to be constant. However, as I told you, when the source is moving, there is the aberration effect, which bends your rays in the direction of the velocity. And therefore, the ray which is reaching you as an observer is not the same at the start than after the velocity has built up. Now, of course, while this motion is building up, your black holes are revolving, are circling each other. And therefore, basically, okay, you're here, you have a maxima, your gravitational wave goes down, goes down, goes down. And then when you come to this point where the second black hole would pass by your original line of sight, this is not anymore your original line of sight. Your line of sight is already at another point. So your maxima will appear later or earlier, depending on which direction the rays pointing to, or in which direction the ray has changed. So this is going to be something you see in your detection as a phase shift. Therefore, the aberration of gravitational waves is introducing a phase shift. This is something which, as far as we understand, is unique to gravitational wave sources. You don't have this in light sources because gravitational wave sources are macroscopic objects, so you can't really make this relation between position and line of sight. For light sources, this is different. You don't have like an electron passing by, which makes you a minimum or a maximum. So this is also the reason why probably no one has think previously about the effect of aberration on phase. Good. Now that I have introduced to you the aberrational phase shift itself, let's go to the detectability of the aberrational phase shift. Let's say, cool, it's not, we know it's there. We know this is going to affect our phase, but the question is, of course, how strong is this going to detect our phase? As I told you, for the Doppler shift, it has been shown that it is going to be detectable. So the first thing that we do, or we did, was to compare the aberrational phase shift to the Doppler shift. Here in this plot, I show kicks, where we assume that the kick velocity builds up as like a Gaussian bell, which is an approximation used by many people. And we assume that the building up of the velocity is in a constant direction. This is, of course, only approximation, but it's a pretty good approximation, let's say. And for this case, we compared how the Doppler phase shift builds up and how the aberrational phase shift builds up. That means these plots show the difference between the phase of a source moving to a phase which is not moving, not the evolution of the phase itself. And we divide it by the final velocity of the kick so that we can get this result independent of the final velocity. The first plot show a case where the velocity and the line of sight are almost aligned. The third case show a case where they are almost perpendicular, and the second case something in between. For the first case, you see that the Doppler shift builds up very strong. The aberrational phase shift is quite smaller, but is in a similar range. And this is something you see for all the cases. The aberrational phase shift is a bit weaker, but they're in a similar order. Indeed, I showed mathematically that to lowest order, the Doppler and the aberrational phase shift are both proportional to the velocity, to the magnitude of the velocity. One interesting thing that you can see is that when the Doppler, or that the Doppler phase shift goes down, the less the velocity and the line of sight are aligned, because as I mentioned before, the Doppler shift is proportional to the velocity along the line of sight. But for the aberrational phase shift, it's there exactly in the other direction. The less aligned the two are, the stronger the aberrational phase shift appears to be. This is because the aberrational phase shift is sensitive to the velocities perpendicular to the line of sight. This is something we think is very nice because the Doppler shift basically has this restriction to only one direction. And now with the Doppler shift, you can get the other directions. So you can get more information and additional information, not that you only see the same thing again, but really also other information. And the third thing you can see in this plot, and which is probably the most important one, is that when you consider the total phase shift, this means the aberrational plus the Doppler phase shift, which is something that what you really should do, because it's not that you can decide to see the aberrational or not to see it in your gravitational wave, it is there. So you have to consider both together. And if you consider both together, then you see that for all cases, the total phase shift is significantly enhanced. So more or less independent of the direction of your velocity relative to your line of sight, you are always going to have an effect on the phase due to the motion. Now let's get to the other kind of sources, to the triples. Here, our model is basically as follows. We assume a constant orbital velocity, but because the source is orbiting around the third body, the direction of your velocity is changing. So the previous case was more or less building up velocity magnitude with constant direction. Now we have constant velocity with changing direction so that we can have a full analysis of the properties. The plots show again the difference of the phase shift, now divided by the orbital velocity, and also the ratio of the periods of the inner and outer orbit, that means of the orbit of this binary black hole emitting gravitational waves and of the orbit of this binary circling the third body. And here over one period around of the binary around the third body. In the first case, we show a case where the ratio of the two orbital periods are not very different. The outer orbit lasts around 30 times longer than the inner orbit. In the second case, 100 times longer. And in the third case, around 300 times longer. The first thing that we see is that the magnitude of the aberrational phase shift depends on the time scale. That means if the time scale of the gravitational waves themselves, which is related to the inner orbit, to the period of the inner orbit, is similar to the acceleration, which is related to the period of the outer orbit, then the aberrational and the Doppler phase shift are almost equal. When the frequency is higher than the time scale, or when the time scale of the orbit is higher than the time scale of the frequency, then the aberrational phase shift starts going down. However, in the cases where they are similar, the two are again very similar in their magnitude, only when the outer orbit lasts much longer, then the aberrational phase shift is relatively weak and can always be, or is not that prominent. Good. Now that we have understand a bit about how the aberrational phase shift behaves, the last thing I would like to discuss is how likely is this going to be, or how easy is this going to be detectable, the aberrational phase shift and the motion in general, considering the aberrational phase shift. The two plots here present the cases on the left side of the kicks I discussed two slides ago, and of the triples I discussed in the last plot. And what this shows is the so-called signal-to-noise ratio. The signal-to-noise ratio is more or less how loud your source is compared to the detection you are doing. So therefore, the higher the signal-to-noise ratio, the easier you are going, is it for you to see the source in your detection. And we show it over the velocities, the velocity, the final velocity of the kick and the velocity of the orbital period. What this line shows is assuming that you have detected your source, how much signal to noise ratio, so how strong does your source need to be for you to then extract information about the particular feature. That means if, for example, here, you have a signal to noise ratio lower than the blue line, you are not going to see the effect of the aberrational phase shift. If EDF signal to noise ratio, which is higher than for you as the observer is possible to extract information about the aberration of phase shift. Therefore, the lower the line, the better, because it's easier to detect, or the less good your detector needs to be able to extract the information. And the first feature you can see for all, and which is something you would expect, is that the higher the velocity, the lower all these lines, therefore the easier it is going to be to detect any of these effects. The second point you can see is that the aberration, or the aberration of phase shift itself, requires the highest signal to noise ratio. So therefore, it is not going to be very easy to detect the aberration of phase shift by its own, or it would require quite strong sources. But if you consider the total phase shift, the aberration of phase shift plus the Doppler phase shift, which as I repeat, is what you really should do because both of them are there, then the detectability is going to be much easier than by only, and then if only the Doppler phase shift would be there. Moreover, so the important point here is taking the total phase shift into account, the aberration phase shift, the detection of motion is always going to be easier. It will be always, always going to be easier. In the best case, we found here from these six plots, not the best case in general, but from these six cases, the detectability is enhanced by a factor of 1.8. That means that you need 1.8 lower signal to noise ratio in order to be able to see the motion. This means in turn that you will be able to see sources which are 1.8 further away from you as an observer, which is nice because translating this into the number of sources there you would be able to see is 6 times. Therefore, considering that the aberration of phase shift is there, is going to increase the number of sources you will be able to see. Another point which is important is, okay, as I said, the effect will be there, and it's important to take into account in order to not misinterpret your sources. Let's consider this plot, and assuming you are making a detection and for some reason you have the signal to noise ratio of 100. And you maybe don't know about my paper, or just don't care about my paper and say, okay, I only will interpret my detection considering Doppler shift. Then only considering the Doppler phase shift, you would deduce that your source is moving with 1,800 kilometers per second. And you say, okay, cool, wow, this is the fastest source we have ever seen, whatever. But the truth is that you should be considering also the aberrational phase shift, and that your total phase shift is really related only to a velocity of 1,000 kilometers per second. Therefore, taking the aberrational phase shift into account, it's important to not misinterpret your sources, because otherwise the phase shift can appear to be much stronger than you would expect. Okay, to cut a long story short, let me remind you the most important points in my presentation. First of all, most gravitational wave sources are not completely at rest. We tend to assume it, but this is not true, because they're most likely going to be in some systems, therefore they will be orbiting the center of the system, they will be interacting with other bodies. Or even if they are not interacting at all, they will start moving themselves because of the emission of gravitational waves. One important point is that despite this fact, there is no general way or no general kind of template which can describe the center of motion of a gravitational wave source. This is something we need still to include in these templates, or at least in some of them, and therefore you need a way to describe it, where one part is the Doppler phase shift and the other is the aberrational phase shift. To include this information is important because otherwise you will be misinterpreting your source, you will be missing some part of the information, and this could lead you, for example, to interpreting the sources to being heavier than they really are, or maybe even more exotic things that you, for some other reason, claim that the face is going to be shifted, but maybe it's only the velocity, and there are ways to include this a posteriori to your to your templates using the aberrational and Doppler facial. And I want to highlight here again, I presented this aberrational phase shift, which is something new, which has not been studied previously, and which will significantly enhance the detectability of gravitational wave sources, will help you as an observer to interpret your sources correctly when you're interested in motion. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. Here is the literature I use in my presentation. And if you like my presentation, I would like to in particular recommend you this paper. This is the paper on which the presentation today was based. Thank you again.